Dr. Reed is a practicing nephrologist in Columbus. He trained at UMC and UAB, Birmingham, Alabama, and he's actually a medical director of 5 dialysis units and 1 acute hospital. Dr. Reed likes to be known as a doctor who works. He works very well with the nurses. He's in day-to-day contact with nurses, so he understands the day-to-day running of dialysis units. He understands the problems that we all have as nurses, and you'll be able to see that in his presentation.
Thank Anna and American Regent for your sponsorship. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be with the nurses. I think this group knows how to multitask better than anybody in any medical industry, and my hat's off to you for what you do every day for our patients. Betsy and I will talk with you today about a new direction that we have taken in our iron management in the CKD or pre-dialysis area, and for definition purposes, where you see the NDD, we're basically talking about pre-dialysis patients. So anyway, these are objectives, and I'll go over the trials, particularly looking at oral iron therapy versus IV, and Betsy will review the obstacles to success and protocol development.
First, I'll have a general review of non-dependent CKD patients and anemia, and then we'll get into the use of IV iron in this population. Well, these are the stages, and I think most of you are very familiar with this. These are the stages of chronic kidney disease and the estimates of prevalence throughout the United States. And if you look at its prevalence, we're talking about 20 million people that are afflicted by some form of chronic kidney disease. And to go through them by stage and GFR, and GFR being simply a measurement of remaining kidney function, and you can generally say that from 0 to 100, that represents the remaining function a patient would have. So for stage one, that's someone with very minimal disease with a GFR over 90. It's about 6 million people in that group. For stage two, GFRs of 60 to 89, it's about 5 million people in that group. And for stage three, GFRs 30 to 59, about 7.6 million people. Now note the big change to stage four, 400,000 people, GFR 15 to 29. And look at stage five, which is the patients I assume most of you are seeing in dialysis units with GFR under 15, only 360,000, I think is the number today. So, big question, what is happening stage four and five patients? I think if you look at the patients you see that enter the dialysis unit that haven't been seen in a clinic or pre-dialysis treatment, you know the answer very well. These patients are dying before they ever get to ESRD. And in a sense, it's only the lucky ones that make it to this point. And as you can see by stage and by percentage, at stage four, there are more people dying than reaching dialysis. And the group that's not mentioned there in this Medicare five-year follow-up is the event-free. So if you put them in, it could be even more impressive as to the number that really come to see us in dialysis. Well, this is a slide that I put in at the last minute because I like in the CKD talks with my referring physicians to think about what is it that I can do to slow the progression of chronic kidney disease as a whole. And no question, the top three are our big targets, antihypertensive therapy, management of anemia, and proteinuria. So we'll look at anemia today as a very important risk factor in slowing the disease process. And for all these, we do have very good data. And we'll look at the biggest problem with early referral, and that's being able to get the patient. And we can talk all day on that, but I'll just tell you, that's one of the challenges that we all have in nephrology, is getting that patient in time to do something for him so he may not come from a hospital to your dialysis facility. Well, how prevalent is anemia in stage 4 CKD? You can see that by percent affected in stage, it's clearly with hemoglobin less than 12, more than half the patients in stage 4 are affected by anemia. Well, how does severity rank as a marker for risk progression? And if you look at the baseline hemoglobin as it worsens from 13.8 towards 11.2 on the right, and you plot that against the risk of doubling of the creatinine, which was pointed out in the RENAL study several years ago, but it's still very important data, and it's a very linear relationship. And if you look at the patient less than 11.2, you follow that up and over to the hazard ratio or the risk of doubling, it's a 4 times greater chance of progressing to ESRD as marked by hemoglobin less than 11.2. So if anemia is the big problem that is predicted here, what can we do about it, and what are the causes? And unquestionably, as the kidney shrinks, EPO deficiency sets in. The secondary causes of iron deficiency, number one, inflammatory conditions, and hyperparathyroidism are also very important. So today we'll talk about iron deficiency and what causes it and how prevalent is it and what we can do about it. Now, this slide is a little bit complicated, but if you just look at the blue line as the females and the yellow as the males, and as kidney function deteriorates, and look at the TSAT under 20 and ferritin under 100, you can see by gender and function that there's as much as 20 to 70% of people that are iron deficient by these criteria. And obviously the female's having a larger blood loss. But by stage four, with GFR in this case 30 to 50 by this study of N. Haynes data, you can see that clearly 40, 45% of all patients are deficient in iron. And you might say, well, 40%, how big is that? Point being, what is the percent incidence of this in controls matched males, for instance? It's less than 1%. So there's a 40 times higher incidence of iron deficiency when you add CKD into the formula. Well, what are the causes of iron deficiency? Well, number one on the list in our clinic is bleeding. And most of this is GI bleeding that goes with the territory, so to speak, of a very sick patient with lots of problems. Number two is impaired absorption, which may be due to lack of intake from poor intake of iron-containing foods. And if they've been to our clinic and we found a high phosphorus, we compound the problem with our binders that may bind up the oral iron. Finally, the ESAs, or erythropoietin stimulating agents, clearly increase the demand for iron. And you can see that where's the blood in the body? I mean, where's the iron in the body? It's in the blood. And as the ESA agents stimulate blood making, there's no question there's a huge demand for more iron to be mobilized. So keep that in mind as we go into the presentation on IV versus oral iron and how much reserve iron you have, because when you start at EPO, there's a tremendous demand for more iron. Well, we'll go into the references here on whether iron alone or with EPO, which is better in this population. We'll also look at oral versus IV iron and what is the evidence for one over the other. Well, the early studies, and this is a study by Silverberg some years ago in 2001, and it's a little complicated, but if you'll look at the light line, that's iron sucrose only, and the darker line on the top of each slide is IV iron plus EPO. And if by time, this was a 6-week study, by 42 days, looking at the hemoglobin between 8 and 12, there was unquestionably a significant rise in all targets, hemoglobin, iron sat, and ferritin. So if you read the paper further, 1/3 of these patients with iron sucrose only needed no EPO. I think that's a very important point that we need to point out in the chronic kidney disease clinic, given the difficulties we have in coming up with the agents, and Betsy will tell you more about that. Well, prior to a few months ago, these were the three randomized trials that had been published on whether IV iron was more effective, less effective, or equal to oral iron in the non-dialysis dependent CKD patient. And what the study showed is that the IV iron was equal to oral iron in two of the three, and IV iron was better in one. Now, this has already been proven in your dialysis population, and your own Becky Wingard, who I think is with us today, published studies on the hemo and PD patients years ago that IV was better. So where is the evidence now with this conflicting data today? Probably largely due to design problems, there was a need for another study. And Dr. Van Wyk published a study 2 months ago in KI, and he basically took a new approach and did a randomized trial comparing IV to oral iron. And he looked at oral iron for 6 weeks with ferrosulfate, 325 milligrams, three times per day, and IV iron either by a 200 push or by an infusion of 500 milligrams over 3.5 to 4 hours. And the patients were rigidly controlled, had to be in stage 3 to 5, hemoglobin's less than 11, TSAT's less than 25, and ferritin less than 300. And what was different in this study from the others that helped control for variables is that the patients either had no EPO or the EPO was not changed during this 6 weeks time. And the evidence was much more clear, I think, answers the question for us. So we'll go through the individual slides, but as far as the IV iron being superior to oral in managing anemia across the board, obviously our biggest indicator would be the delta hemoglobin, and in this case, rise of hemoglobin of 1 point. And over the 56 days of treatment, you can clearly see that IV iron was superior to oral iron. Now, in looking at the stores, as I told you, it's very important that we have iron stores available, particularly when initiating ESAs. But to get the ferritin into the range of 200 to 300, the IV iron was far superior, no question. If you look at the bottom line here, the red line, the time from initiation to the end of the study, oral iron never made target. So I think we've gone through the same process that Becky did with the dialysis-dependent patient, and we've come up with the answers here. And I'll show you some more ways to look at this. In summary, if you look at the delta hemoglobin, there's no question that IV is better. And ferritin's over 160 better, but looking at both together, it's a remarkable enhancement of outcomes here with IV iron over oral in terms of success rate. Well, what about what factors are important here in determining probability of treatment success. And this is pretty straightforward, but again, number one, EPO use. Number two, severity of anemia, hemoglobin over 10. And three, GFR under 45. Now, if you look at combinations, and most combinations show even more, no EPO with GFR under 45 with very, very high probability of treatment success. And taking that most severely anemic patient, hemoglobin under 10 with initiation of EPO, that was the group that had the most benefit of all. Now, in terms of safety, and Betsy will talk more about this in protocol development, but the 200 push is now FDA approved. And there were no serious adverse events in Dr. Van Wyk's study. And I think that's very comforting to us in the CKD clinic, and we found that same experience as we have administered a great deal of this over the last couple of years. Well, I'd like to end with giving you some of our outcomes, so to speak, real world outcomes. And this is data that was collected by my colleague here over a three-year period from 2002 to 2004 in our own clinic. And I want you to get a sense of what the CKD clinic concept, as well as anemia management, did for patients that are coming to you. And this is where I'd like to try to tie the importance of the CKD clinic and anemia management together for you and the patient. I think you'll very clearly see what it did for us. If you look at first 90-day hospitalization and the percent of patients on the left and whether or not they were a patient in our clinic or not in our clinic and whether or not they had anemia management, you can see that 33% of this garden variety people that we started on dialysis had hospital days compared to 11% if they actually came to our clinic. And if you add treatment of anemia in any way you want to define it, it was down to 8%. So it's a fourfold decrease in first 90-day hospitalization. And, you know, for the acuity problems that we see, I think that's a real remarkable outcome. And we're very proud of that. As far as mortality, you know, which is the bottom line here, is can we save lives with this? And if you look at what our outcomes were by site, whether we'd seen them, and compare them to network for clinic versus hospital, you see in the first yellow bar that network hospital starts had about a 9% overall mortality. Now, in our hospital starts, we did a little better, 5.4%, and we think that's because we've been out talking about this and we had less of them. We actually decreased hospital starts by 75% during this period of time. If you look at network clinic starts, it's about 4.6%. And if you look at our Columbus clinic starts, patients that we followed in the CKD clinic, at the end of this three-year study, we did not have a death. We're very excited about that. It gives us lots of energy to go on and push this program outside the dialysis unit in our own practice. Now you say, what's in this for the anemia manager, and how excited were they about this in our PD and our hemo units? If you look at the mean hematocrit in the CKD clinic, patients that we saw, mean of 33.7. For those we did not see, 27%. Wow, does that make a difference, bringing somebody in that's that well? And how well do we know that anemia is such a marker of hospitalization rate and marker of mortality? So our anemia managers were very excited when we began to send them patients that had these kind of numbers. Now, as far as PD, do we have PD nurses here today? Great. This is a slide that I take a lot of pride in, but I have to give the credit to this lady on the right. The choice of PD modality relating to the number of months we followed them. And you see in the first bar, the low bar, 13%. If we did not see a patient for more than 4 months, we had little chance of impacting their modality. Whereas more than 4 months, 88% chose peritoneal dialysis. Now, how many actually went to PD? It was in the 50% range. These numbers conflict rather significantly with published data of 50% and 35%. But I will tell you what my assessment of this is. First of all, I believe that these patients saw us long enough, even though 4 months doesn't seem like very long, to have things done to them to make them feel better. And if you think about those uremic patients that we see in the hospital, I'm not sure they're thinking well enough to know what we're talking about. So with correction anemia, carrying more oxygen to the brain, I propose that they can more clearly make a decision. And then I think after they feel better, they develop a trust, the whole team, and more Betsy than me, because she spends more time with them and really develops that relationship that it takes to lead a patient to do what you think's best for them and for them to have that opinion. So our PD nurse has been very happy with this. And as far as the hemo nurse, I think this is the really big slide, access place prior to starting dialysis. 78% of the patients in this study were able to go to hemo with an access in place. And we're very proud of that. And as you can see with people that didn't come to clinic, we still got a few accesses in, but not near what we did in the clinic outcomes. You might say, what does this have to do with anemia? This is just a spinoff. This is another outcome that related to the overall program that we have. So in conclusion, anemia does affect the majority of patients with stage 4 CKD. Iron deficiency is very common. And IV iron is superior to oral iron in this pre-dialysis group of patients. And from our own clinic slides, you can see that improved outcomes seen with anemia management and all the things that it led us to be able to do while we followed these patients. Now, I'll turn it over to Betsy now, and she'll tell you more about how we made this happen and develop the protocol.